Now don't say, ladies and gentlemen. Every period in Jewish history brings to bear its own unique challenges. External and internal forces interact in a dynamic pattern which both fuel and test Jewish life. In our own time, we, the last of the oppressed and the first of the redeemed, have observed the miraculous and the mysterious. We have seen revival and renewal, and we have known erosion and decline. Religious observance and education have intensified, while trends of disassociation are quickly outpacing affiliation. We are here in a conference dealing with leadership because we know that the image, the composition, and the power of the American Jewry is seriously threatened. External forces and internal shifts have also produced dramatic changes in how rabbinic leadership is manifested and perceived by others and by ourselves. While we form a critical component of the religious, intellectual, and communal leadership, our roles and functions have taken on different priorities and definitions, with increasing and ambiguous congregational demands. In an arena crowded with competing demands and professional scars, some of us have retreated into reticent insulation and isolation. Some of us have allowed others to tax our kahuna, deplete our nevuah, diminish our malchus, and they will define our anivus. In many areas of communal leadership, some of us have abdicated to secular leadership, who persist in pursuing agendas which will allow Jewish life to be reduced to the lowest level of Jewish expression. And some of us have not taken advantage of the very powerful and wise force of our lay leaders. We who lead and serve, guide and mold the constituencies of the covenant are here because we want to take active roles in shaping the world for tomorrow. We want to respond to new circumstances, invent new structures, create new coalitions in responding to the future. We are here because we work in worlds where people desperately require meaning and definition in the corridors of human endeavors. And we have a historic legacy from prophets and pietists, saints and seers, to lead and to serve, to challenge and provide. And we're here because we want to take stock and evaluate. And we have the individual with us tonight who can help us do that, who can assist us in the process. He needs no introduction because he has already led the way for leaders by paving the roads for tomorrow. He has inspired with a royal reach. He's enhanced with an ethic of leadership. And by being here, he imbues us all with dignity. I give you, it is my honor, Rabbi Lamb.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Rubenstein. Before I begin with the formal remarks, I just want to comment how pleased I am that upon coming here this evening, I received unanimous voices of approval and joy at the fact that this is probably the best convention we've had in many, many years. So to Rabbi Rubenstein, your co-chairman, Rabbi Rourke, to Rabbi Gorelick, to all of you, a great Yeshiva Kolach. It's a pleasure to see you. When I was invited, I was told I have to give a title. And I gave a title, and no one knows about it. So let me tell you what the title is and why I chose it. The title is Sheep and Shepherds, Ruminations on Leadership in Jewish Thought and Practice. Let me explain what I mean. Sheep and Shepherds, or Son V'Roeh, are the biblical metaphors for leaders and followers. I prefer that particular symbol of Son because of the obvious relationship of sheep and lamb. And both, after all, are classified biologically as ruminants, So the beginning of the subtitle, Rumination. And he started with a little bit of Milford the Medusa, and it's up now, right? Puns aside, I'm going to share with you tonight some very serious concerns that I have. Concerns that perhaps some of you may think that it's better la'avor aleihem b'shtika, to keep quiet about them, and just go on. But as I told some of my colleagues earlier this evening, I recall a letter by Rav Kook, the Chaim Brocker, who spoke up. He was ill at the time, but he did take time to speak up against some kind of sacrilege by the Chiloniim, and he said, Pashut, ein li koach lishtok. I don't have the strength to keep quiet. So I'm going to speak about certain matters that bother me, and I think they should bother you. Because in our machna, especially in the ranks of the RCA, as well as Yeshiva University, the spurning of leadership roles has become a generational phenomenon. When I got smicha a long, long time ago, it's about 42 years, leadership was something that we naturally expected to exercise. It was a self-understood element in the responsibilities that the Rabbanus imposes upon adults. Whether and to what extent my generation of rabbis and the one before mine executed this duty is quite beside the point. The fact is that we knew we were expected to be leaders, and that leadership was part and parcel of the functioning rabbinate. That stopped being a fact about a generation ago. For years now, young men have been choosing chinuch over rabbanus, education over the rabbinate. And that is not only, although largely, but not only because of their ahavas haTorah and because they want to be involved in learning all the time, nor even only because of the scathing criticism of the American Orthodox rabbinate in some circles, and by people who, ironically, after all these years of savaging the younger rabbanim, now cry bitterly, what happened that there's no longer a rabbanit in America? But that choice of chinuch over rabbanit, if we have to tell the truth, is also because they fear the responsibilities of leadership, communal and halachic, and prefer a profession which is safe, which keeps them linked to Torah, but limits their leadership to 20 or 30 children. The result is, and I don't mean by any means to be critical of those who are going into chinuch because they happen to love chinuch or are qualified for it. I mean those who are going into it or who went into it because of negative reasons. The result is fewer men in the rabbinate, fewer good men in the rabbinate. The ones who are there are doing extremely well, but there are fewer good men in the rabbinate, and of those who do enter, for many of them, hardly any assumption that a rav must be a leader, a doer, a mover, a shaker, a challenger of the status quo. Such leadership is more evident in some other Orthodox circles. Witness the aggressive outreach programs and the entrepreneurial enthusiasm of groups such as Lubavitch and some of the yeshivish circles, and Yasha Kocha, may they continue. But somehow we have become fearsome, or fearful, not fearsome. I'm concerned because the problem is far more than theoretical. To my mind, it touches on the very destiny of our community, the community defined by Yeshiva University. I understand that's not a good word nowadays. Yeshiva University, the Yisraelis Rabbanim, the UOJCA, Young Israel, Mizrahi, Poland, is Pole Aguda, similar group, the women's group, and is both cause and effect of our perceived weakness. Indeed, all the talk about our supposed weakness becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, especially in the absence of adequate, vigorous, confident, and influential rabbinic leadership. The metaphor of stone v'roeh holds, because in our sacred literature, we often refer to the Ribono Shel Olam as our shepherd, and hence our leader. And Yom Kippur, we say to him, Anu Tanecha V'Ata Ro'enu, based on the Midrashic statement, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Yisrael, Atem Tzoni V'Ani Ro'eh. So it's God himself who sets the pattern for such implied leadership, and human leaders are therefore involved in the act of Yehalachta Bedrachav of Imitatio Dei. When such leadership is absent, it is therefore an ominous sign that some element of emuna is missing from those who have the personality and the intellectual capacity for leadership in the community, but fail to exercise it. Shepherds who do not lead are in effect abandoning their sheep, the Almighty's own condition. It is a problem that requires urgent attention, and one in which we ought not dismiss cavalierly. What are the failures, the causes of this widespread failure of leadership in our ranks? I suppose there are many contributory causes, like everything else in life, but I'm going to single out three of them. Intimidation, the fear of controversy, and self-doubt. And let's begin with intimidation. The most obvious reason for this change of disposition in our own machane is that we have allowed ourselves to be intimidated. We have absorbed and internalized the criticism by all kinds of ideological adversaries, both without and within our Orthodox camp. And when you begin to feel uncertain, diffident, indecisive, waffling, you abandon any pretensions to leadership, you tend to retreat within yourself, and you do things that will attract the least criticism, in fact the least attention, and avoid any semblance of controversy. In a word, you surrender your rights as rabbinical leaders, your autonomy as thinking individuals, your duties as manhigei ha'eda, and we become self-proclaimed victims. And forgive me for the term, sometimes we become, and I'm including myself along with everyone else, except for this company tonight, ecclesiastical wimps. Instead of being roei tzon, we have ourselves become sheepish, afraid to move out of the flock, and so have abandoned our sacred responsibility of being shepherds of our own flock. Please don't think I'm overstating it. If I am overstating it, it's to the point of emphasis. I don't mean it. Everyone is that way, chas v'shalom, but too many are that way. Too much of Orthodoxy today is in the grips of a straitjacket of personal autonomy and independent thought, imposed even on the most learned and distinguished, who yield all too easy to blatant terrorism, to a diktat backed by intimidation rather than persuasion. How else explain the scandalous absence of so many of the leading Rosh Yeshiva of other yeshivas at the funeral of the Rav Zecher Tzadik Livracha, or at the Hesped Mar conducted at yeshiva? Did none of them appreciate and respect adequately the Rav commanding the onus? Or how explain that outrageously condescending obituary article on the Rav in a magazine of an organization that pretends to speak for all of Orthodoxy? I give credence to the report, and I think it's more than a mere rumor, that there are those who wanted to attend the funeral of the Azkara and were warned not to. And that was done as a result, or especially that nasty eulogy that appears, was a result of a psak issued by someone who apparently controls all actions and thoughts of the most distinguished and learned Talmidei Chachamim, Rabbanim, and Rosh Yeshivas, or at least some of them, who personally were aghast at his decisions but afraid to protest them. Some examples. I know a rabbi, see. Some example of rabbinic leadership. These are not my models for true gedolei Torah and self-esteem that Torah should instill in the ben Torah. It's an example of the violation of the Seguru Mitzayish. I prefer the example of our own great Rabbi Rav Zatzal, who spurned controversy wherever he could, always tried to avoid polemics, but never, never compromised on principles. If we are to consider ourselves his Talmidim, then we must not revel in his Hidushim and his Doshis and Dabdivei Mashova alone, but must learn also to adopt in our own individual and communal lives his Bakoshas HaEmes, without fear and trepidation and compromise. I'm going to refer to a I came up toward the end of the convention, so I'm afraid to say anything about Korach. Let me go back to the Meraglim, the cipher. There's a hidden dimension to the story of the Meraglim, which relates directly to our theme. When the majority of the espionage team reported that the conquest of Canaan was impossible, they uttered four rather unremarkable words, Kichazaku Mimenu, normally translated, for they, the Anshei Canaan, the Anakim, are stronger than we are. But Chazal gave that a different twist that cast an entirely new light on their character and disposition. They comment, and it's different as far as I find in Bavli, Yerushalmi, and Medrash. In the name of the Shlokish, Hitichu Dvarim Klafei Ma'ala. What they did is they referred to the Burnish Elenim. Mimenu means not they are stronger than us, but they are stronger than him. They refer to the Rebbeinu Shalom, that the Canaanites are more powerful than the Rebbeinu Shalom. Now I ask you, these were the Nesiei HaEda, the Rosh HaShvatim. Were they so primitive that they really thought that in a contest of strength that the creator of heaven and earth would be defeated by humans, giants and no giants? These are people of Nesiei HaEda? I don't believe that was the case. What then did the Rish Lakish mean by this rather bold statement? I believe he meant this, that they were intimidated. They were intimidated by the giants into giving up on their own most cherished principles, facing the possibility of adversity. They just threw in the towel, they surrendered their beliefs, they turned heel and ran, leaving their ideals behind them. They knew what the truth was, but they were intimidated. And anyone, especially a Nasi or a Manhig or a Rav, who is so easily cowed that he gives up his ideals of what is right and decent and noble and holy and worthy, is guilty of sheer blasphemy as if he had abandoned his faith in a Kol Yakol and an omnipotent deity. I often think about this chronic timidity which afflicts us, and I must tell you that in a bittersweet mood, I amuse myself with reflecting on what future historians will have to say about us in our machane, and how we have acquitted ourselves. Two examples come to mind, two examples that make me laugh and cry at the same time. A few years ago, not that long ago, I was looking for a Rosh Yeshiva for our Bris Kollel in Yerushalayim. One man, let's call him Rabbi Y, accepted the offer when I sent my Menahel down. He was a great Talmud Chacham, a renowned Talmud Chacham, Hashem Dovah, and he accepted, and he invited the class to come to his home in Yerushalayim for a shiur, and I thought that was a very, very wise and warm thing to do, to make Talmidim feel personally welcome. When I came to Yerushalayim, I discovered that not only the first shiur was that way, but the second, the third, the fourth, and the fifth. And I discovered that the man had never set foot on our campus in Yerushalayim, at the Gross Institute. So I spoke with him, and I asked him for an explanation. The man was honest. He said that his Kaverim and his Talmidim, even his own children, found out that he was teaching at a Yeshiva University campus, they would break his windows. You can understand that that ended his brief career at Yeshiva University. When I told him that so-and-so, if one great Messiah Hassanus of a Nish design, I have to legish. We're not going to act like a concubine that you have to be ashamed of us. Now this was not, I must tell you, this is not the first time that I heard this defense of spinelessness. What I call the plate glass argument, that on the zerbrechen des Scheiden are the defensive. People are afraid their windows will be broken. It has become almost a cliche in Orthodox circles. We have become dulled to the absurdity, the immorality of this crumbling before terrorism. Some archaeologists poking around the ancient records of the Orthodox community of the late 20th century will undoubtedly prepare a learned paper to a society of scholars in which he will decide that the most important factor in the destiny of Orthodoxy, the most critical element that accounted for theological and communal positions, was neither halachic differences nor differences in Ashkava, but rather the chronic shortage of plate glass for windows in Orthodox neighborhoods.
Everyone is afraid they're going to break the window. Can you imagine that this should be an element in the approach of great Talmidei Chachamim? It's scary. The new version of the Marxist materialistic philosophy of history. Shortage of plate glass. The second example is a bit more recent and probably as disturbing. Indeed, you'll forgive me, but I heard that it came up at a recent board meeting of the RCA and occasioned no comment whatsoever from anyone else. Rabbis will be reluctant to be forthright in advocating or disapproving of a policy or idea or person because he fears that it will in some way prejudice his children's chances for a proper shidduch. Here's what I say. I approve or disapprove, or I just keep quiet because I'm afraid it will harm my daughter's chance for a shidduch. This is no less than mind-boggling when you step back and think about it. What kind of people are we? What kind of rabbonim are we? To what levels of pseudo-leadership and spinelessness and self-contempt have we defended that this is a concern that silences us so effectively? And what kind of person will want a machutin who will disqualify his child because his or her father has the guts to be honest about what he believes? Anyone who submits to this kind of threat, forgive me for being blunt, but I mean it. Anyone who submits to this kind of threat ought to get out of the rabbinate and seal his mouth forever from uttering any opinion on anything of importance except for the weather. The rabbinate must never become a sanctuary for moral cowards. And permit me one more comment on the Malagon story, which can shed some light on the same theme of leadership. The famous verse, famous pasuk, "Vanehi be'einenu kechagogim, v'chein hayinu be'einehem." The Gemara and the Seita, the Lamed Hei, quoted by Rashi, tells us that the Malagon came, and wherever they came, they found a funeral. For some people, that would be just marvelous. And they climbed up the Arazim, the cedar trees, and they felt and looked like to the giants who were at the Hesped, they looked like Chachagogim, they looked up and they said, "Yep, look at those grasshoppers who look to have human form." Because I'll add one more word, one more item that's fascinating. They said specifically, whose funeral was it? And the answer, Eov, noch nafshei v'atre delkula amma behespeide. Eov died then, and the entire world, all of Canaan, was involved in the hesped and the funeral of Eov. What does Chazal have in mind when they chose Dafke Eov as the one who expired that day that the Meraglim came to Canaan? After all, they weren't repeating a historical fact that could be found in some ancient records. They had a kavana here. They meant something. Let me try it. Let me try to uncover their kavana. I believe it was an answer to an unasked but very real question. And the real question is this. Is it really possible that other than Yehoshua and Kolev, not one single one of these eminent princes of Israel felt that they were betraying both Moshe Rabbeinu and the Rebbeinu Shel Olam himself in giving this devastating report? Kolev and Yehoshua were the only ones? I mean, is it conceivable that each and every one of them, Kol Nasi Behem, Kulam Anoshim, Rashi B'nai Yisrael Hema, had no qualms, no inner doubts, no hesitation about what he was reporting? Only 2 of 12 understood their responsibility to the Rebbeinu Shel Olam and to Moshe who sent them? Or worse yet, according to the Yerushalmi, there weren't 12 spies, there were 24. Isha Echad L'Shav and Isha Echad L'Shav, that Rabbi Akiva holds, it was double. The 12 that they are mentioned are only the Nisim, but there were 12 others. So 2 out of 24? Can you imagine 22 of the greatest Jews at that Dar Deya? And none of them could understand what they were doing? I can't believe it. They must have had more religious intelligence than that. Surely at least 2, 4, 5, 10 thought that they were making a dreadful, historically tragic error. What then? They failed to talk up and speak on behalf of their true feelings and their deepest convictions. They allowed themselves to be intimidated by colleagues, their own colleagues, with the loudest and most strident voices and the greatest self-confidence and self-righteousness. And that's what Chazal meant by saying that Eov died that very day. Eel was the classical biblical case of a man who would not allow his conscience to be silenced, who spoke up in defiance of his colleagues, his society, his friends who tried to intimidate him with their pat answers. Eel was a man who was willing to argue with the Ribbono Shel Olam himself, and he was not about to let himself be pushed around by well-meaning friends who had nothing more to offer than tired cliches and conventional platitudes, which Eov knew were empty and dishonest. In the name of honesty, he who was ready to strive with the Borei Olam was not going to yield to mere mortals who had no insight whatsoever. And that, I believe, is the significance of the Agada that Eov died when the Menachem arrived in Canaan. When you try to silence a man as independent, as honest, as clean, morally clean as Eov, you make place for moral cowards and spiritual weaklings who can be intimidated into giving up their holy mission on behalf of Am Yisrael and Moshe Rabbeinu and the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. In a sense, what Chazal meant was that the spies and Menachem were responsible for Eov's death because Eov could not abide the likes of people who are the polar opposites of what he stood for, who had no inner core, who substituted excuses for principle, fear for faith, compromise for conviction, people who are supposed to lead but who declared their bankruptcy as leaders, who failed their people and failed themselves. And the second cause that I discern for this paralysis of leadership is an innate fear of controversy. We have become oh so delicate, so gentle, so timid in the face of criticism. You know, some of our most angry critics of the Peace Now movement in politics practice that same Peace Now philosophy of submissiveness when it comes to principles that we have cherished all our lives. I can appreciate that some of us, all of us, where it should be, are reluctant and should be reluctant to be involved in controversies. Machlokes, after all, is an issue of the Adaisa. But we must remember that not all Machlokes is Usa. Pikiyobis, Machlokes Sheinu L'Shem Shemayim, which is such as Machlokes Kardach V'chol Adasa, I finally got him in, whereas a genuine, non-personalized argument, L'Shem Shemayim, such as that of Hillel V'Shamai, is not only banned, it's encouraged. Listen to the words of Rabbeinu Yonah in his comment on this Mishnah and Ovid. I treasure it. I found it by error, actually, must tell you. I never thought it referred to. But so true. He writes, Kol machlokes yu l'shem shemayim so-called l'hiskayim. L'chorah, it's a strange thing. A machlokes with l'shem shemayim will keep on lasting. You would think that a machlokes she'en l'shem shemayim would last. But a machlokes l'shem shemayim get over with it quickly. Just for care. Hakavana. She'la olom yiskayim uba machlokes. He's talking about his machlokes l'shem shemayim. La'olam yiskayim uba machlokes. Hayom yichlokes b'davar echad ulamachar b'davar acher. The machlokes yiyeh kiyum v'nimshach b'neihem kol yemei chayeihem. V'lo od ela she'orech yamim u'shnos chayim yosifu lahem. Yes. This is a remarkable, I hate to use the word because it becomes so politicized, pluralistic insight. Controversy, if it is not ad hominem, not political, not a grab for power, not an expansion of one's ego, not for the sake of merely winning an argument and making debated points, but literally for God's sake, L'shem Shemayim is one of the greatest virtues. Of course, it must be understood that even the most elevated controversy involves criticism. It's the nature of intelligent debate. But for what? Didn't Hillel criticize Shammai and Shammai criticize Hillel? Not personally, but their approach. And who was the most criticized and unpopular Jew of his own day? Moshe Rabbeinu. Not the number. Moshe Rabbeinu was more criticized. I mean, he was feared. He was respected. But he wasn't loved. There were Cheshedim on Zela. There were Cheshedim on Geneva. There were Cheshedim on Ish Ashish. I mean, even the Rabbanim don't have quite that package to carry. So, if what we believe and what we say is L'shem Shemayim, we simply must not be afraid to enter the fray come what may. It is the only way to attain, as Rabbi Yonah indicated, intellectual longevity and vitality. I'm reminded of the story of a young fellow who came to shul during the week. He put on his talis but didn't put on tzon. People looked at him, his neighbor broached it to him, the gabbai approached him, the shamas reproached him. I mean, oh, my cloaker started, wouldn't do it. Finally, the Lord came and said, "You're the man. Why don't you put on tzon?" He said, "I'll tell you, Rav. My father, before my father died, he gave me a tzavor. The tzavor is, vazich l'sharayna makloikis. Don't get about makloikis. This is tzon, the makloikis, Rashi, and I made a tam. What kind of tzon you wear? Don't put on tzon altogether." The final reason for the abandonment of leadership roles, and perhaps the most fundamental cause, the most troubling, is our own self-doubt. We suffer from an inner failure of philosophic nerve. We have been bullied into doubting our own shita, the one on which we have built our personal and professional lives. When one or another of the size that surrounds us shouts loud enough and long enough, we begin to wonder if maybe the one on which we have built our personal and professional lives. When one or another of the size that surrounds us shouts loud enough and long enough, we begin to wonder if maybe, just maybe, we are wrong all along. Maybe the others are right and we are in error. And there is nothing more deadly than that kind of pernicious self-doubt. It can kill a man's initiative, his dignity, and finally his integrity. This, then, is a time to reaffirm our faith in our own most fundamental principles, and I need not identify them. You are aware of them. And our confidence in the correctness of our convictions, assailed by right and by left, we must stand up with courtesy, with respect, but with strength, with both the courage of our convictions and the conviction of our courage. There is a time for self-questioning, even for a degree of self-doubt. But now is not such a time, especially now that the Lord is not here to be our protective shield. The kind of Yiddishkeit that we stand for, that we learn from him, must be reasserted when it is assaulted. You know, the letter Ayin in Shema Yisrael, in Shema, is Ayin Abosi, it's written large, and many reasons are given. The Chanshin of Pearl Hirsch explains, it's large, you should not mistake the Ayin for an Aleph. Shema Yisrael means hear, O Israel. Shema Yisrael means maybe Israel. Maybe God is one. The word Shema, when an aleph means maybe, perhaps, it is a sign of self-doubt, of hesitation, of unsureness. Such shema is the very opposite of shema, which connotes a commanding certainty and rightness. We are attacked for being true to the Torah heritage in many circles, supposedly making us Orthodox Jews as Neanderthals, as benighted advocates of anti-democratic intolerance. And at the same time that the left, the secular world, the secular Jewish world, goes into Orthodox bashing and paints us all with one brush as these kind of relics of an ancient day or wild-eyed fundamentalists, the Khomeinis of the Jewish community, we are assailed from the other side, disqualified, delegitimated for not being authentically Orthodox because we do not pay obeisance to an organization which lays claim to be the anointed apostle of absolute truth of Sinai, to the exclusion of non-members and non-sympathizers. Or because we believe in Torah Amada. And I tell you, we believe in Torah Amada. And so did the Rav. He was our paragon. And when he believed in Amada, it was Amada. It wasn't only an excuse. Or because we affirm that the state of Israel is no exception to the principle that everything in the world is guided by Hashgacha Elyona. We do not subscribe to the idea that everything happens, even a blade of grass that a malach must tell, or a person no kevez, but everything is by the Hashgacha except for the founding of the Medina. Or for our assistance that Klal Yisrael includes those who do not necessarily agree with us on every count. But no matter where the attacks come from, we simply have got to have the strength and the courage to proclaim Shema for our principles Shema and not Chas V'Sholem Shema. Kenneth Clark concluded his massive study, work called Civilization, with the words, "It is lack of confidence more than anything else that kills a civilization." What we have cherished as our interpretation of our Torah civilization is to thrive and flourish. We must rid ourselves of a Shema stance and return to a firm, self-respecting Shema attitude. You want unity with the rest of the Orthodox community? It can be achieved if we will be what we are and not feign to be something we are not. When I was a young Rav, some 40 years ago, I delivered a sermon. I think I had it printed in an RTA manual. I no longer can find it. I remember the title. I called it The Leaning Jews of America. Do some people remember that?
Sure.
Okay. I'm quoting myself. What's that? Fun? I'll quote, because George Bernard Shaw used to say, I love to quote myself because it adds spice to my conversation. One Yoredeya analogy that I made there may still be of some relevance today. I pointed out that the halachic test for the questionable kashrus of an animal, because you may have a sefer, a tefis in the kutah shedra, is to hold the spine at its base and see if it wavers or leans or bends to one side or another. If it leaps to one side or another, it's safe. If it stands erect, it is kosher. And that, in sum, is what I am treating to you, my friends and colleagues of the RCA. Even a rabbi has to be kosher. Even a rabbi has to have a backbone, a spine that doesn't crumble or bend over submissively. And such backbones are in all too short supply in recent years, and it's time that we kept kosher in our rabbinic households. Nothing less than erect backbones will qualify us as self-respecting and abundant and mandigam. Can we do it? Can we do it? Can we overcome our timidity, our fear, our inner doubt? Of course we can. Not only can we have done so. We've proven ourselves. And many of you are proof of it. RCA members are the ones who alone man the ramparts of orthodoxy when Reform and Conservatism are riding high. In the days when they mocked us, proclaiming that we had no future, that we were doomed to ideological and denominational extinction, that we were being swept into the ocean of obscurity and oblivion by the undertow of the inevitable and inexorable triumph of modernity and the non-orthodox varieties of Yahadut. But we did not submit. So many of us possessed adequate backbone that we did not submit. We, you, your predecessors for the last two or three generations of Rabbanim, resisted the intimidation, overcame the distaste that we have for controversy. We stilled our considerable doubt in order to survive and prevail. We cleaned up the mikvahs in this country. We described Taharas and Mishpacha and other sensitive topics which have been swept under the carpet for centuries, We set up a system of communal kashrus. We built day schools. Yes, we built a day school. We learned to speak English properly, and not to fear that speaking English properly is an embarrassment and a sign that we're amadatim. We became as or more educated than our balabatim, earned their respect, and thus transmitted to them the eternal lessons of Torah in an idiom they understood and in a manner they could respect. We did it. And all this while, we were under relentless attack from the right. Now how I remember those days when the Agudat Rabbanim and others denied that we were authentic Rabbanim, tackled us in every way, made life unpleasant for us when they ridiculed us as the moderne Junger Rabbanim. These critics were numerically fewer than our critics from the left. Today, what the French say, tout se change, tout se la même chose. The same groups are still at it and at us, even though the tables are turned in terms of power and passion and vitality. We showed then that we have a kosher spine, and we've got to show now that we have a proper backbone. Not everything we do is right.
Not everything we do is right. Our balabatim aren't perfect. And it's an open secret, neither are we. We're not perfect. Not everything we say is necessarily the dogmatic truth. What is most shocking about that statement is that anyone should be shocked by it. In this atmosphere of everyone propounding his own absolute infallibility, it's nice to be able to admit that we are not infallible. And not everything we say or do is beyond or above criticism. But our basic principles, our fundamental shita, is one which we have inherited from our Gedolei Olam, going back to Dr. Revel and Dr. Belkin and Berov, Zecher Tzadikim Levracha. And we have no need to seek or beg approbation or haskamah from anyone else. I cannot conclude without giving proper proportion to my remarks, and that is that there is a dimension that ought not be neglected, namely, the many of you, who have demonstrated and now demonstrate superb leadership abilities. You are the mustavi, the models for all the rest of us. There are people amongst you who have been forthright in speaking up for what we believe in, with dignity, with courage, with chokmah, with Torah. You have organized sheyudim in memory of the Rav Zatzal, who are marbitei Torah, malamdei Torah, barabim, in a way that inspires us, who have represented us with great efficiency and effectiveness, with both daring and dignity. And all the rest of us, particularly our new Rabbanim, our younger Rabbanim, must learn from you the meaning of authentic rabbinic leadership. Yiyasha kochachem. And I thank God that we have you in our midst, and that means so very many of you. So friends, let's resolve. No more intimidation, no more fear of advocating a cause we consider right and righteous and in consonance with Torah and our holy Mitzvah. No more gnawing self-doubt as to the justice and rightness of our cause, not when we are involved in great confrontations on the canvas of history. That is the only way to reassert our genuine role as leaders, as Rabbonim Vua Manhigim and Roei Tzon Kodeshim. Because if Anhi Be'einenu Kachagogim, invariably Zechein Hayinu Be'einehem. If we do not respect ourselves, no one else will.